So I'm going to be moving away from the topic of reionization in my talk to discuss the evolution of the ionizing background, the ultraviolet background, from redshifts of about 6 to the radically low redshifts of 0. So I'm really going to be changing the tone a bit here. I just wanted to outline a few of the things that I'm going to touch on. I'll talk first about some of the methods that are classically used to infer information on the ultraviolet background radiation field, namely the proximity effect method from both quasar spectra in terms of the line of sight proximity effect as well as the transverse proximity effect. If I have a chance, I'll talk about the proximity effect as it relates to galaxies in the sense of it being in the spirit of this conference in the galaxy IGM interaction. More so than using it to say anything about the ultraviolet background. I'll also talk about the technique whereby the transmissivity in the Lyman alpha forest is used to infer the intensity of the ionizing background or the ionization rate in H1. And then the idea will be to compare those, of course, with various calculations and censuses that have been done of the sources of the ionizing background, namely quasars and now even faint AGN at high redshifts, galaxies, and various re-emission processes in the IGM, and even structure formation, thermal emission from structure formation. I actually won't say a lot about those last two. Simply, I'll mention that they're potentially important contributors and are included in some models. So I probably don't really have to tell anybody here why we're interested in the ultraviolet background, because it directly determines the thermal ionization history of the intergalactic medium through these two equations for the ionization rate and the heating rate in the IGM. So this is an important, of course, input into various hydro models that one might do to model structure formation in an expanding universe. So the proximity effect has been known for now almost 25 years. Its existence has been known for that long. It's basically just a deficit of Lyman alpha absorption lines near a quasar emission line due to the ionization effects of the quasar itself. So it's parametrized in the way shown here. If you parametrize the line density in the Lyman alpha forest as a power law, then that power law is changed near the emission redshifts of quasars by this factor of 1 plus omega, with some power law describing the column density distribution of absorbers in the forest. And that factor omega is just the ratio of quasar flux to the mean background flux at the Lyman limit as a function of redshift as you move towards the quasar in the spectrum. So it's the cartoon. Along a line of sight, you will intersect various structures in the intergalactic medium, which is essentially manifests itself as the Lyman alpha forest, with a line density that goes as 1 plus c to the gamma. And that is mitigated essentially by the expanding universe and the mean intensity of the metagalactic field. Then in a quasar's region of influence, which is not necessarily a sphere, the mean background is that the background is now the mean background plus the contribution from the quasar, which varies with distance from the quasar. And so again, that line density is changed by that 1 plus omega to the minus beta minus 1 factor. So here I'm just schematically showing the redshift range about 0.1 that is generally described as the proximity region in a quasar spectrum. This is mainly just to show that even in a high redshift 3.5 quasar spectrum, you really don't see any obvious line deficit in any one spectrum. But if you look at a sample of quasars in aggregate, in this case even a low redshift sample of quasars from the FOS archives, you do see a very significant deficit of lines as a function of this parameter omega. So on the y-axis here is the redshift evolution corrected line distribution. So I've taken out the 1 plus c to the gamma power law in the Lyman alpha forest, and now this is just the proximity effect that you're looking at. So if there were no proximity effect, these points would simply come all the way across at 1. So the point is that when you look at a large sample of quasars, you can play this game and use the balance between, I should say, the evolution of the line density in the Lyman Alpha Forest and then that deficit in the proximity region to infer what the mean background is. I just want to say I'm not going to really talk about all of these systematics, but there are many things that can cause you to go wrong in this kind of analysis, and there are many more of them that will actually cause you to overestimate J, this mean intensity, as opposed to underestimating it. So whenever one is trying to come up with a model that can explain the ionizing background, it really behooves you to remember that in terms of the proximity effect measurements, you may not necessarily want to aim that high. So here's the summary plot of the mean intensity of the ionizing background as a function of redshift. And this is summarizing what we know from proximity effect measurements. I'm going to ignore the redshift zero points for the moment and come back to them later. The black curves are the calculations of Hardin-Madaw, which include the contribution from the known population of quasars with reprocessing effects in an inhomogeneous intergalactic medium. So it does include that re-emission component. And then the points, as I said, are proximity effect measurements. And what you notice right off the bat is, particularly in the low redshift measurements, that the error bars are quite large, which is simply because our line densities are very small, which leads you to a wide likelihood function and a large error bar on the value of the mean intensity. At higher redshifts, the error bars are a bit better. And in particular, the point at redshift 2 agrees, generally speaking, with the contribution from quasars only. Again, though, as I said, this is likely to be an overestimate rather than an underestimate in terms of the systematics. So the fact that it lies above the quasar contribution may mean that it's still, in fact, consistent with it. As you move out to higher redshifts, the green points are some measurements, proximity effect measurements from the literature. And of course, you can see that they all lie systematically above the quasar contribution, indicating perhaps another population contributing to the background at redshifts greater than 4. So let me also now mention the other technique that's generally used to measure the ionization rate in the intergalactic medium. One can take a large sample of quasar spectra and compare that to hydrodynamic simulations in the sense that you can scale this parameter mu, which is just the ratio of the baryon fraction to the H1 ionization rate. You scale that parameter to match the mean flux decrement in the Lyman Alpha Forest in your simulations to the observations. And then you can go further and use the shape of the flux decrement distribution to constrain cosmological models. But in general, what people will do is assume some value for omega baryon, some concordance value, and then infer the ionization rate from the flux decrement in the Lyman Alpha Forest. So that was done by McDonald and Miranda Escuday, and I've just corrected a few of their points from what they've published as a correction to those calculations. The main point is that from a redshift of 2 to a redshift of 5, you see a steady drop in the ionization rate as measured from now this flux decrement or transmissivity technique. And that drop in the ionization rate is much smaller than you would predict if you just went out and calculated what you expected the drop to be based on the drop in the quasar space density. This we'll probably hear more about in a couple of days from Songela, but she has also done this calculation and extended the measurement out to redshift of 6, and you see that there's a steady drop again from redshifts of 2 to redshifts of 6. So we've known for a while about the existence of high redshift quasars out to redshifts greater than 6 from the Sloan survey, and now there are many more, which I'm sure we'll hear about tomorrow. And one can take all of those high redshift quasars and estimate what from that what the space density of these objects is, And so this plot is showing the result from the, including the all of the high redshift Sloan quasars. And you see that the quasar space density peaks at a redshift of about 3, falls dramatically to redshifts of 6, and I'll discuss the implications of the fall from redshifts of 2 to redshifts of 0 in a minute. So what one can do then is, knowing something about this quasar space density, the population of quasars, about their continua, you can calculate the contribution that they would make to the number of photons needed to ionize the intergalactic medium. And this critical rate is shown here by the dashed line. This is a calculation done a few years ago by Madal, Hart, and Reese. Indicates the critical ionization rate, or critical number of ionizing photons, that are required to ionize the IgM to the Gunn-Peterson limits that are observed in quasar spectra. Namely, the fact that we don't observe a steep Gunn-Peterson trough in quasars to redshifts out to 5. And the quasar contribution, you see, starts to have a problem at redshifts of about 3.5 or so. And this is an estimate of what galaxies can contribute at those redshifts for a certain assumption about the escape fraction of ionizing photons from those systems. And that's, of course, a parameter of great interest. I'll say a bit more about that as well right now. This is a composite spectrum of Lyman-Bright galaxies, 29 Lyman-Bright galaxies, at a mean redshift of about 3.4. You see a residual Lyman continuum flux, indicating that some ionizing photons are, in fact, escaping from these systems. Now, whether that means the escape fraction is as large as 50% is still unclear, and probably not the case, in the sense that when you look at Lyman-Bright galaxies that have more representative Lyman-alpha equivalent widths, that aren't the bluest, brightest Lyman-Bright galaxies out there, you actually, this is just an example of two of them, you don't see that residual flux. So there's some question now then about how many ionizing photons Lyman-Bright galaxies can in fact contribute. So these are some results that attempt to incorporate all of this. These are results from cosmological simulations that include radiative transfer and include IgM re-emission as well. And they compare their results to the proximity effect measurements shown by the hatched region in these plots. The top plot, the main thing to take away is that from the top plot, again, you see that quasars have a hard time, basically cannot reproduce the mean intensity as observed from the proximity effect, maybe the lower limits on it, but certainly to redshifts out to 4, it starts to fall well short of it. In the bottom two plots, the contribution from galaxies does help. And in fact, their claim is that a galaxy integrated star formation rate that actually rises with redshifts at redshifts greater than 3 is required to match these measurements. and that's also reinforced in these plots. This is showing the sort of H1 decrement, that Lyman alpha transmissivity technique approach of inferring the ionizing background. So you see at the top now that quasars alone can't supply the mean decrement from the data. Those are the points in each of these plots. Whereas quasars with a galactic component that falls between redshifts of 3 and 5 also doesn't compensate for that enough. A galactic component that rises, in fact, does give you a pretty good match. And they claim that their galaxy emissivities, as shown here, can match the, in their model M2, this is the one that rises with redshift, can match the data for escape fractions sort of that lie sort of between the values that have been inferred from those Lyman-Bright galaxy measurements from Seidel et al. And Giolongo et al. That I mentioned earlier. So this is an interesting result. So as all of this has been basically driving home, some contribution from galaxies, star-forming galaxies, has to be the case at redshifts greater than 3 or so, in order to reproduce even the proximity effect measurements. So this calculation is essentially showing the same thing. The quasar contribution is the thin solid line, or the thin line here, and the galaxy contribution and the total contributions are shown as well for various assumptions about the escape fraction of Lyman continuum photons from these galaxies. Now, they place a high escape fraction of about 40% on the Seidel-Edel result, and you see that the inferred ionizing background lies well above the proximity effect measurements in that case. Whereas if the escape fraction is low, such as what's been observed at low redshift from ultraviolet observations of starburst galaxies, escape fractions of about 5 to 10% may in fact be more likely. So some new results on the volume average star formation rate from high redshift galaxies also give us some reason for concern in terms of the contribution from galaxies. This result from Bunker et al. Shows that the star formation rate is actually falling towards, these are UDF measurements, falling towards high redshifts of 6, and that even if you consider the photons from these systems with an escape fraction of 1, you fall short of the Gunn-Peterson limits at redshifts of 6 by a large factor. So perhaps what this is saying is that there are still some quasars around. This is basically just saying what can galaxies do at redshift 6. There may be some changes in the IMF at these redshifts which can compensate for this and various other caveats to that. But those are just the latest measurements of the galaxy contribution. Some recent work on the contribution of faint AGN also shows some interesting results. This is some work on faint AGN that have been observed in the fields of the Lyman Break galaxies. And the luminosity function that was measured from these quasars was found to be significantly flatter than the local pay value that's generally used in the calculations of what quasars contribute to the ionizing background. So that has important implications on what quasars contribute. And their claim here is that the contribution of AGNs is about half of what's been previously calculated, and only about 10% or so of what Lyman Break galaxies contribute at redshift 3. Whereas in some calculations, quasars actually contribute roughly equally to Lyman Break galaxies at those redshifts. And so the upper limit on the contribution of AGN to the UV background in this scenario is substantially lower, and even lower than what the proximity effect measurements indicate, which is about a factor of 3 or so larger than that. In an interesting paper, these authors turned the question around and used the observed ultraviolet background to place limits on the population of faint AGN. And so in this plot, I'm basically showing, or they're showing rather, the expected number counts in the HDF and Keck AGN surveys. In the HDF case, it's a limit, and the Keck is shown in the bottom plot, the bottom panel here. So the points are the expected number counts based on the ultraviolet background from calculations by Fardal et al. From the lower limit on the proximity effect measurements, and from the flux decrement Lyman alpha force transmissivity technique for measuring the background, which tends to get values that are factors of 2 to 3 lower than the proximity effect. Again, perhaps pointing to a systematic effect in the proximity effect measurements. In any case, what they find is that the AGN surveys can't find enough AGN to supply the ultraviolet background, even for escape fractions of 1. So this is considering the contribution from galaxies and from AGN, and even if you infer it, assume an escape fraction of 1, you find that the surveys don't reproduce what is observed from the proximity effect shown by the squares here. You can't find enough AGN, essentially. You can get agreement with the proximity effect lower bounds for escape fractions of about 20 or so. And you can get good agreement with the flux decrement type of measurement, but only for small escape fractions of about 5%. So let me now shift gears and talk about the redshift evolution of the ionizing background. I just want to say a few words about extending the treatment, the proximity effect treatment and the measurement to low redshifts and why we're interested in doing that. One of the main reasons was to explain this flattening in the Lyman alpha forest, DNDZ. This is a well-known result that the DNDZ flattened significantly at low redshifts as observed by the Quasar Absorption Line Key project from on the FOS. And simulations by Ramil DeVay and collaborators showed that this flattening in the DNDZ, shown here by the points, is largely driven by evolution in the ionizing background. So the fact that I showed earlier from the 2DF results that the space density of quasars is falling drastically from redshifts of 2 to the present-day universe is manifesting itself as a flattening in the distribution of Lyman alpha forest absorbers from relative to what you, if the ionizing background stayed at its redshift 2 level and the universe simply expanded, you would expect this type of evolution, which you don't see, that continuation of the high redshift parallel. So let me draw your attention now to the low redshift points in this plot that I showed earlier. again, the proximity effect measurements with large error bars are in agreement with the quasar contribution at these redshifts less than 1. And locally, the ionizing background can be inferred directly from recombination emission from intergalactic Lyman alpha clouds. And the contribution of the various sources can again be calculated. Scholl et al. Found from their calculations that AGN and starburst contribute roughly equally to the UV background at redshift 0. but it should be noted that these estimates of the contribution from AGN have relied, as well as most other calculations of the contribution from AGN, have relied on essentially the composite spectrum of the EUV of quasars from the HST composite spectrum of quasars. Those were all compiled from AGN with redshifts greater than 0.3. So some new results from the Far Ultraviolet Spectroscopic Explorer, or FUSE, indicate that the EUV continuum of quasars may in fact not be so easily represented as a minus 1.6, 1.7 power law, as is generally assumed in almost all models. If you look at the top plot, you see the HST composite spectrum plotted along with our FUSE composite spectrum, which consists of which was compiled from 128 spectra of 85 AGN, all at redshifts less than 0.7. FUSE has a wavelength coverage all the way down to 912 angstroms, and so you can basically study the EUV of quasars all the way down to redshift 0. And you see from this that the FUSE composite is significantly harder than the HST composite. This is the spectral slope that we measure from those data. And we attach error bars based on considerations of uncertainties in the correction for the Lyman alpha forest, which actually isn't as extreme, of course, in the FUSE sample as in the HST sample. But we account for that, as well as for various other possible systematics in our analysis. And so we see that the FUSE composite is distinctly harder, and we see enhanced oxygen 6 and neon 8 emission in the FUSE composite relative to the HST spectrum. Now, if you look at the luminosity and redshift distribution of these AGN, I said the fused state are all from redshifts less than 0.7, HST all from redshifts greater than 0.3. And the median luminosity in the fused sample is about an order of magnitude lower than the HST sample. So perhaps basically what we're seeing here is a manifestation of the Baldwin effect, whereby low luminosity AGN show enhanced emission lines, in particular high ionization emission lines like oxygen 6 and neon 8. And in the models, it might be interesting to look at some dependence of the EUV continuum slope of quasars on the luminosity of those objects. This is a plot of the spectral slopes of the individual AGN in the fuse and the HST samples as a function of their luminosity, their luminosity at 1100 angstroms. And in the HST sample, they saw no correlation. But when we combine the HST sample with the fuse sample, we do see a significant correlation of the spectral slope with luminosity. So what are the implications for that on the AGN contribution to the UV background? Well, if you basically follow the Scholl formulation for doing this calculation, you calculate the observed intensity from AGN as the integral of the emissivity with some factor to account for the effective opacity of the intergalactic medium. And the emissivity itself is the integral of the luminosity function, which is measured in general in something like the B band. So you have to extrapolate from there into or to the Lyman limit and then into the EUV in order to derive the emissivity of the ionizing photons. And so if we change this number, this alpha S, from the standard minus 1.7 to minus 0.56, what happens to this? And I'll just show this is the Pei luminosity function, which Scholl et al. Used. This is their model for the differential opacity in the intergalactic medium, the d tau dz, which just gets plugged into that integral. And now this is just a zoom in on the plot I was showing earlier between redshifts 0 and 1. And the point is that if you include a steeper continuum slope, then the AGN contribution is raised by a factor of about 1.7 or so at redshift 0. So if you add that to the galaxy contribution, as calculated by Scholl et al., you get the solid triangle shown in that plot. Now, this is still consistent with the direct measurements, those limits that are set by the fluorescent emission at redshift 0. And so what would probably be the most interesting thing to do, though, would be to take the the alpha S here and just place it inside that integral and perform the integral where this now depends on the luminosity of the quasars. So I want to go on now to talk about the spectrum of the ultraviolet background and what we know about that. One of the most powerful tools for inferring the spectrum of the ultraviolet background is helium-2 Lyman alpha absorption at 304 angstroms, which can be observed with STIS and with fuse for redshifts somewhat lower than what HSD can reach because of its bluer sensitivity. We can learn about the spectrum of the ionizing background by measuring the ratio of the column densities of helium-2 to H1, which depend on the ionization rates for H1 and helium-2 according to this equation in photoionization equilibrium, which can be estimated with this expression at the bottom. And so you can use this ratio eta to constrain the ratios of the intensities of or the intensity of the background at 1 and 4 Rydbergs. And that's been done in particular for the sight line along the line of sight to the quasar HE2347 minus 4342 in a series of papers that have dealt with the fused spectra of these of this object. And what one of the interesting results from that paper was that a correlation between this parameter eta, which is shown at the top, for all these different absorbers, and the environment essentially of the absorber in terms of its H1 absorption, was found in the sense that higher eta measured in the spectrum, the higher values of this helium-2 to H1 column density, were found in voids in the H1 distribution. And if you turn that around and use the expression that I showed in the last view graph to infer what the spectrum of the mean spectrum of the sources that's giving rise to that ionization must be, you find that a softer ionizing spectrum must exist in the voids than in the filaments, pointing either to some type of local source of soft ionizing photons, such as star formation in galaxies, or filtering of the mean quasar background, a harder spectrum, by the intergalactic medium. And this point is also made in this histogram here, showing the distribution of the spectral indices inferred from the absorbers in the filaments, which show a harder spectrum, and in the voids. And this is the distribution from the HST data of the quasar EUV spectral slopes. So, also, from these same data, the increase in the helium-2 Lyman alpha optical depth as a function of redshift, I should say at redshift 3 essentially, was found. This is now thought to be the signature of helium-2 reionization. This is consistent with other lines that have pointed to this, from such things as reheating or heating of the intergalactic medium from this reionization process, as observed in the H1 line widths and in the H1 opacity. So the fused data have allowed us to pin that down with even more certainty. It's been known for some time that the ratio of silicon 4 to carbon 4 in intergalactic absorbers changes abruptly at a redshift of 3 or so. This also pointed to some change in the nature of the ionizing spectrum at a redshift of 3. So the story is starting to gel in the sense that at a redshift of 2, you start to see some disagreement with the proximity effect measurements and the contribution from quasars from various lines of inquiry. And you see that at this redshift, the spectrum of the mean background is changing. So the implication is that at high redshifts, you have a softer background, perhaps dominated more by star formation in galaxies, whereas at low redshift, you have a quasar-dominated, harder ionizing spectrum. So I wanted to say a couple of words in my last few minutes about the transverse proximity effect and what we can learn from it. Many years ago, Dobruzhsky and Bechtold found a prominent void in a spectrum of a quasar to redshift of 3 in the Lyman alpha forest, and found, in fact, a foreground quasar that they took to be responsible for that void, although it required some anisotropy in the quasar's emission because it was offset from the redshift of the gap of the void by a few thousand kilometers per second. Now, in helium-2 observations, Heap et al. Found a high opacity in this gap, in the Dobruzhsky-Bechtold gap, indicating perhaps that there's a soft local source that they didn't find that's responsible for that void in H1, which doesn't produce a void in helium-2. And they report another gap in helium-2 at a redshift of 3.06 or so. And in some other work, a void was found in another spectrum at a redshift of 2 with another foreground quasar a few megaparsecs away from that. And a comparison, you can use that same transverse proximity effect to infer the ionizing background in the same way that you can use the line of sight proximity effect. And when this author did this and compared the two values that he got from the line of sight and from the transverse proximity effect, he was able to infer that the foreground quasar had changed in its ionizing intensity. So one powerful consequence of this transverse proximity effect is a method for inferring something about quasar lifetimes. Another interesting result, recent result, was from Jacobson et al., who found a foreground AGN at the position of that Heap et al. Gap in the spectrum of the quasar 0302 minus 003, the same one in which the Dobruzhsky-Bechtold gap was found, and infer this type of geometry for the emission. So because, the quasar redshift is offset a bit from the gap, you have to invoke some kind of ionization cone like this with an opening angle of 85 degrees. And they find that this type of anisotropy and a lifetime of about 10 to the 7 years can account for that gap. I wanted to mention briefly a project that I'm involved with Litsosatsky and others, to use the ESO 2 meter and the wide-field imager with a GRISM to search for faint AGN near the lines of sight to bright quasars. A lot of this work has been completed. About 18 fields have been surveyed. Typically, we find about 3 to 10 candidate quasars per field, including 10 in the field around this helium-2 absorbing quasar, which has interesting consequences for exploring the fluctuations in that eta parameter I was talking about, in the sense of if there are any local hard sources, that should manifest itself in a low value of eta along the line of sight. So the circles are uncertain quasar identifications, and the stars and the crosses are more certain identifications. So some of those lie within a few arc minutes of the line of sight to the background quasar. And some preliminary evidence for another foreground object in the same the field of the same 0302 minus 003 quasar has been found at the redshift of another helium-2 void. So we're finding lots of evidence for the transverse effect. A caveat to that is that it's not seen in some of the Sloan data. If you, in this paper, Rupert Croft has estimated the effect of, well, the transverse proximity effect, essentially, and found that And this is interesting, that even though in the context of the models, these N-body plus hydro models, you're placing quasars in overdense regions, you still predict, on the basis of these top plots for a non-uniform ionizing background, UV background, an upturn in the flux. In other words, you do predict a transverse proximity effect from these simulations. So the overdensity around quasars doesn't completely wash it out. But when he went and compared these models with some data from the Sloan survey, just looking at the transverse effects of all the quasars on all the other quasars in the sample, he found no evidence for that. In fact, found perhaps the opposite in the Sloan data with somewhat large error bars still. But in this paper, these authors have found no transverse proximity effect in three close pairs taken from the Sloan early data release. So the conclusion from this is that they can't get around it with emission anisotropies, because they require unrealistically small opening angles of about 20 degrees or so, which are inconsistent with sort of unification pictures of the geometry of these of AGN. But you can explain the lack of a transverse proximity effect if you require quasars to emit in short bursts with a duration much less than the separation between the bursts, and a time scale of 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 6 years. So I guess I will just go, let me see. I was going to say a few words about the galaxy proximity effect, but since it doesn't directly relate to the topic of the UV background, I'll leave it for now. But I wanted to mention one interesting proposition in a paper by Edelberger, where he suggests that we use the spectra of background galaxies with a bright quasar in the foreground to infer the topology of the IGM, the geometry of the quasar's region of influence in the quasar lifetime. This is somewhat ambitious, but possible given the density of the Lyman Bright galaxies in some quasar fields. And by comparing the signature of the quasar from in the background galaxy spectra at different redshifts, you can infer, again, something about, for instance, the quasar lifetime. So in this plot, a quasar is emitting photons in these concentric circles emanating from it. And a photon traveling from a distant galaxy will travel across this plot and encounter regions in the IGM that were affected by that are affected by ionizing photons that were emitted by the quasar some, say, 90 mega years ago in the case of this region A. Whereas in the case of region B, there's no time delay. And so if you compare the absorption in region A and region B, maybe you can say something about the lifetime of the quasar. So I will not talk about the galaxy proximity effect, but move to the summary. And some closing thoughts on what maybe some open questions are or some avenues of investigation might be. So the ionizing background we now think drops dramatically from redshifts of 2 to the present day, driving the evolution in the Lyman Alpha forest. Quasars dominate the ionizing field at redshifts less than 3, and galaxies, in a simplified sort of picture, probably dominate at redshifts greater than 3. This is the result of the helium 2 change in the helium 2 opacity, and the metal metal line ratios that change at redshifts of 3. Those are the two things that point to that conclusion. Some of the uncertainties that are still wide open are: what are the escape fraction from high redshift galaxies? What is the contribution of faint AGN? This could be pinned down quite a bit better. The existence of the transverse proximity effect somehow isn't in the Sloan data, but it has been found in several other individual cases. So it'd be interesting to pin that down a little bit better. It would also be nice to understand the local sources driving those fluctuations in the helium 2 to H1 ratios along those lines of sight to those helium 2 absorbing quasars. And then, I didn't say anything about it, but the relative role of photoionization and feedback from supernova driven winds in the galaxy proximity effect in terms of trying to model that and reproduce the observations. So some things that might be done immediately that I mentioned earlier in the talk would be to incorporate an AGN spectral slope, simply that varies with luminosity of the AGN, or even investigate a similar type of situation for galaxy escape fractions, whereby different luminosity galaxies have different escape fractions, and just fold that into the calculation. Another thing would be to incorporate the new flatter luminosity functions found from observations of faint AGN at high redshifts. And I'll stop there.
I think we'll hear later in the week from Richard Mashotsky that the sort of X-ray view of evolution of the AGN population from redshift 2 to 0 was way different than what would have been deduced from quasar surveys. So has anyone asked whether if the sort of UV to X-ray emissivity of the X-ray selected sample was like classic AGN, whether this would basically be inconsistent with the evolution of the Lyman Alpha forest from redshifts 2 to 0?
I don't know of any such. You have something to say about it?
How you implement that, it could be one way of saying that is that alpha OX, optical X-ray, is changing as a function of redshift.
Yeah.
Sure, but
you get a higher X-ray distribution of high redshift, but it wouldn't affect much.
No, I guess that's what I'm saying. You could actually constrain that, but you could constrain alpha OX in these X-ray selected samples by the evolution in the Lyman Alpha forest.
So they, right. Okay, so even in a situation where type 2 AGN, you know, you're not looking down the ion as the opening angle.
But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that does this require that the emissivity in EUV to X-rays has changed significantly with cosmic time?
But that doesn't necessarily. It might have ionization species or nitrogen 5 or 6, but not the hydrogen and helium, because there we do see UV restraint in the
Yeah, it'd be interesting to put that down.
I want to talk about a slightly different subject, and that's basically the thing that you about after the day Barger et al. They resulted in this project. But we can actually directly measure the velocity of the X-ray-selected object. Struck from that, we have a bunch of objects that would have been selected.
Well, let me add something that was surprised. You know, classically, the same kind of epitome of the cosmic field was 1.6, 1.7 for many years. And, you know, now this year, 2004, GDF from something that luminosity cosmic field is the alpha 1.1, which is planned, agrees with Hannah. That's equal to 3, etc., and agrees with your
alpha.
And it's surprising that they don't even comment on what went wrong in the previous comment hall.
We comment in our
own way. Okay, you can comment on. But anyway, so there seems to be an agreement now that the faint network is much flatter than before, which means faint USO don't make a lot of contribution to the back.
This one is to verify that the 2DF square of the arm is faint enough to really sustain the faint network. So
I just wanted to mention two results we obtained in a paper with Geary et al. That are somewhat relevant to this, from looking at the ratio of silicon 4 to C4 optical depths. So one thing we found is that if you want to explain the observations with only quasar radiation, you say quasar dominates UV background, you would infer that silicon is overabundant relative to carbon by a factor of 30 compared to the sun, which is very different from what you see in stars. So it's from that we concluded that stars must dominate the UV background. We
what
also looked at this was redshifts 2 to 4. That's the other thing. We also looked for evolution. You showed that plot by Songela, and we and others have found the same thing, that we didn't find any evidence for evolution in that ratio. And what we think we understand why you could get different answers. And that's what we found, which hadn't been looked at before, is that silicon 4 over C4 is extremely sensitive to C4. Because if you have more C4 absorption, you're looking at denser gas, and denser gas has more silicon 4. So if you want to measure the evolution in that ratio, you really have to look at a very narrow bin in C4 optical depth, which hadn't been done by Songela.
Yeah.
So that might be an explanation.
But in any case, the helium too, I think.
Yeah, so that may be in conflict with that, actually.
Yeah.
Yes, well, going back to helium 2, you are seeing large fluctuations in eta or helium 2 over H1. And one way to interpret that is that late helium another possibility is just a changing spectrum. So local sources that dominate a different region of the line of sight.
Well, you see.
Every
Oh, whether it's local sources or whether it's, well, I, no, I think. I mean, I don't know that that's, well...
The argument was the high temperature, but even there, people don't agree about that, so...
For helium, for it being reionization and reionization.
Why don't you show the helium Lyman alpha optical depth, which is similar to what you see in hydrogen at redshift 6, right? There's this big upturn.
That's fine, that's not what it's signaling.
Yeah. I hear you.
Yes, I wanted to go back to your discussion of the stellar or the galaxy contribution to the UV background, particularly, I guess, in light of the recent comments on the flattening of the quasar luminosity function, so that, you know, the starlight has to be even more important. It wasn't, you presented a variety of models. I just wanted you to see if you could clarify this, that are there models for starlight producing the UV background with reasonable escape fractions, that is, I guess you described some of the stuff on the, not the ultra-luminous Lyman break galaxies that had a more moderate escape fraction, that are consistent with the value of the background inferred from the proximity effect? Or is there still a problem there?
Well, in the plot I was showing somewhat earlier, you can get a good agreement for a particular emissivity that rises between redshifts of 3 and 5 that matches the mean, the transmissivity type of measurement of the ionizing background, but would underpredict the proximity effect result. My contention is that maybe that's not so bad. I mean, we know that there are a lot of contributions to systematic effects in the proximity effect that some of which have been quantified, and even when you just compare the two methods for inferring the background, you find the proximity effect gives you numbers factors of 2 and 3 larger. So I would say the fact that those that there's a model that can account for the decrement measurement of the background with escape fractions of 5%, 10%, you know, that's been achieved.
You showed a plot from Sengela with a sudden discontinuity in the hardness of the ionizing background. My own unpublished simulations of inhomogeneous helium-2 reionization show that takes a delta Z of 1 to 1.5. It takes a long time for the bubbles to overlap if they're dominated by bright quasars. And I was just wondering whether that's consistent with other measurements that, I mean, that's inconsistent with what Sengela showed, unless she was looking at one place.
I don't remember. How
is there any data that really addresses the duration of the helium-2 reionization epoch?
I guess, unless,
So other people don't find a certain position, including us, in a certain core or C4.
But do you have a value for delta Z?
No.
I guess as with H1, it's right difficult to define what you mean by that. I mean that the helium 2 change in the opacity there was turning up in a smooth way as you see in the H1. So maybe that's pointing to the same type of behavior.
Or just not publish it at all.
Any other questions? Okay, well, perfect timing. By clarity, let's thank all the speakers again.